we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
In a recent interview, Barack Obama blamed his European allies for not stopping Libya from becoming a, quote, mess following NATO's intervention and the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi 5 years ago. He went as far as to call his allies free riders, saying some of them tried to take credit for the attacks.
You showed the world you would get rid of a dictator and you would choose freedom. Vive Benghazi! Vive la Libye!
Things didn't go according to plan in 2011. The removal of Gaddafi didn't lead to the ushering in of a great new democratic age, and that's obviously been a tragedy so far for the people of Libya. We were way over optimistic about what would happen when we got rid of Gaddafi. We thought that the elections in 2014 would be a solution, and actually they made things worse. And that's the point that I've been making over the last couple of days to people in Libya.
The last of those clips you were just listening to comes as an all-too-rare example of candour on the part of a Western government official. On this occasion, Britain's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, during a recent appearance on BBC Radio 4's flagship Today programme. Johnson's admittance of what has long been a self-evident fact when it comes to Libya arrives over a year on from Barack Obama's admission that NATO's military intervention in the country back in 2011 was the single biggest mistake of his presidency. However, both Johnson and Obama reveal in their respective confessions that such is the moral sickness of regime change that has the elites or ruling classes in the West in its grip, they continue to ascribe the destruction of entire countries, the turning of functioning states into failed states, and the unleashing of societal collapse and chaos as disasters and mistakes. What Libya and its people have suffered these past 6 years was neither the result of a disaster nor a mistake. It was the result of a crime, one of seismic and historic proportions. And to give you a sense of just how seismic, in 2010, the year before the Libyan revolution, quote-unquote, got underway, under the aegis of the UN Development Programme, Libya was considered a high development country, one that was able to boast of social and economic indicators that exceeded those of its neighbours and countries further afield. There was no Daesh in Libya in 2010. There were no terrorist bases in Libya, no refugee crisis, no plethora of armed militias running around the country causing havoc, while the country was ruled by a single government with one parliament, not the three competing governments and two parliaments that exist today. But returning to Boris Johnson for a moment, what are we to make of a British Foreign Secretary who on the one hand avers that Gaddafi's overthrow and murder has proved such a tragedy in Libya, but yet as recently as April of this year was calling for military intervention in Syria, another country that has existed in the crosshairs of Western imperialism in recent years? Are these people actually insane? Just what is it going to take before these fanatics and extremists are satisfied? Afghanistan, the former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan again, Iraq, Libya, Syria, a litany and legacy of crimes unleashed in the name of democratism, which is not, by the way, to be confused with democracy. And speaking of Syria, courtesy of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, we learned recently that during the course of a conflict that has been raging now over 6 years, Israel has carried out close to 100 airstrikes against Hezbollah and Syrian military targets. Might it be a stretch to conclude that the only democracy in the Middle East has, with these airstrikes, been acting as the de facto air force of Daesh, Al-Qaeda, and various other Salafi jihadi groups that have been fighting to push Syria's secular, multi-religious and multicultural society into the abyss? The question answers itself. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, Max Blumenthal is a journalist and author who has written many books, the most recent of which is The 51-Day War, Resistance and Ruining Gaza, which I can promise you is required reading. He also runs a weekly podcast, ModerateRebelsRadio.com, in conjunction with Ben Norton. Max joins me now. Max, welcome to the show.
Good to be on with you, John.
Great to have you. When I listened to Boris Johnson's words recently regarding Libya, I was reminded of the Samuel Beckett quote, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again." How do you locate Libya in the realm of Western regime change in recent years? And what is the significance, if any, of Boris Johnson's admittance?
Well, it was the same as the admittance of Barack Obama, that it was the biggest mistake of his presidency. And at the same time, I think he managed to say, "I didn't regret doing it." You know, one person who refused to say that she regretted doing it was former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And luckily for her in Washington, the war was never explored as a failure of regime change, as a catastrophe that plunged an entire region into ruin, that actually led to Boko Haram getting enough arms to advance across Mali and to displace 1 million people in northern Nigeria. The open-air slave markets were not discussed. The comments by Central Command, U.S. Army Central Command, that Libya had been turned into a failed state, barely made the headlines in the United States. It was all centered around the fake scandal, this kind of pseudo scandal that was a partisan scandal called Benghazi. And we never discussed, even in the Benghazi hearings, how rebels that had been armed by proxy with the help of the U.S. that were controlled by Qatar were involved in the attack on Benghazi, or that Chris Stevens at Benghazi had been involved in the transfer of weapons pilfered from the depots, the arms depots of Qaddafi's defunct army.
Max, just to interject quickly, you're talking about, of course, the attack on the US embassy in Benghazi and the murder of Chris Stevens, who was the US ambassador to Libya at the time.
Correct. And so the US ambassador was in Benghazi to help the run the rat line of weapons and even fighters from Libya to Syria, what a former Hillary Clinton advisor called the bank shot. Because after, this is an NBA, you know, professional basketball metaphor, after toppling the government of Libya, Syria was next on the U.S. target list. And these weapons were what helped militarize the rebels early on before the arms shipments began in earnest from the Gulf states and the U.S. So in the U.S., I mean, I'm not as familiar with the U.K. media as you are, but in the U.S., we really were never confronted with the true horror of Libya. Barack Obama had the intelligence assessments, but he, you know, kept it quiet. And Boris Johnson, you know, is on a trip to Libya and he's forced to reckon with the reality. But it's a little bit late. It's retroactive morality. It's what they call in Israel shooting and crying, where soldiers go out into the field and commit atrocities and they come home and go on camera and pine about what they did on the other side of the wall. And this is what we see our leaders do time after time, because regime change has never worked except for a small elite. Figures, for example, like Nicolas Sarkozy, the former French premier, who was basically being bribed by Qatar around the World Cup at a time when Qatar wanted its hands on Libya, and France made off with a good, good portion of Libya's state reserves and its oil profits. So there are people who've done very well around Libya, just very few of them happen to be actual, normal, average Libyans on the ground.
Now, Barack Obama, his entire stick, the quote I gave about him admitting it was a mistake, it was during an interview in which he essentially blamed Cameron and Sarkozy for dragging him in to this military adventure reluctantly, and he talked about the fact that they had no skin in the game, which I believe is a sporting metaphor courtesy of the US, which means they didn't really commit to this project and objective. Do you countenance that from Obama? Do you give him any get out of any culpability? Do you excuse him? Do you exculpate him on this basis at all?
Well, Barack Obama is one of the slipperiest presidents. I mean, when it comes to domestic policy, he would blame Congress every time for tying his hands when he could have issued executive orders or invoked some kind of constitutional authority. And in this case, he blames everyone but himself. He ultimately, at the end of the day, made the decision to lead NATO's campaign against Libya. He was pressured from within by Hillary Clinton, by Samantha Power, who is kind of the guru of humanitarian interventionism and who's simply been wrong about everything. Susan Rice, the National Security Council chief, was another interventionist who was pushing Obama, but he could have pushed back. I mean, he had the CIA director Bob Gates on his side. Vice President Biden was not certainly in favor of intervening in Syria, and he was may have been skeptical about Libya. Bob Gates writes in his memoir about what he calls the backbenchers, and these were the 30-somethings in the Obama administration who are captivated by the Arab Spring, and they thought that we had to simply do something for moral reasons. And so Barack Obama kind of sided with them, and what we saw was a disaster that could have easily been predicted. Now we have Alan Cooperman from Harvard University's Belfer Center, which ironically is now hosting Samantha Power with a fellowship. And we have the British Parliamentary Report telling us that from the beginning, the Libyan revolt was violent and militarized, and it was controlled by groups like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which is an Al-Qaeda affiliate.
Yes.
And, you know, you know something about that in the UK because the MI5, because of Belhaj, and the MI5 has hosted a community of LIFG fighters in Manchester, one of whom was the father of Salman Abedi, who went to Libya and Syria to train with ISIS and came back and killed 20 people at an Ariana Grande concert.
And so just quickly to interject, that's all been swept under the carpet since that bombing attack took place. It's all been swept under the carpet, the fact that this was part of a Libyan network and that MI6 was actively affecting the passage of Libyan militants, Islamists, over to Libya in 2011 to take part in the so-called revolution.
Yeah, I don't know if I can, kind of dive into that really quickly, but I wrote about the case of Mohamed Mwazi and actually went to the UK and interviewed some people who knew him at Cage UK, which is the civil rights group for the Muslim community, which has been under surveillance. And they told me that Mohamed Mwazi had been monitored. This is Jihadi John. This is the person that your listeners will know as the black masked executioner of ISIS, who beheaded James Foley, the American journalist, on camera. He was the most famous terrorist in the world for some time, and he's from East London. And they told me at Cage, we knew Mwazi. He was under constant MI5 surveillance. They basically ruined his life. They prevented him from taking an IT job in Kuwait. They monitored his every move, and then he turned up in Syria. And I said, how did he turn up in Syria? They said, well, we just don't know. It's pretty obvious how he turned up in Syria, same way that Ramadan Abedi and Salman Abedi turned up in Libya. Their MI6 sent them there through their rat line to simply ventilate the internal extremist threat they were facing and turn it against an external enemy where they wanted to effect regime change. So this is another aspect of regime change, is the UK's intelligence services using extremists on its own home soil for its goals abroad. And of course, they come home and the disposal problem takes various forms.
Blowback. Yeah. And by the way, this would not be the first time. We obviously understand the history of Afghanistan in the 1980s, where people such as Osama bin Laden were being hailed as freedom fighters, when the US and the UK were using the Mujahideen, as they were called then, as proxies in their own foreign policy interests, and at that time in the context of the Cold War. And it's the same policy continuing, regardless of the consequences, the short-term thinking, because you cannot take a tiger by the tail, can you, Max? And this is a Frankenstein monster that they have helped to cultivate. And now, when it's blown back on the streets of London or Manchester or over the US, then they throw up their hands and say, we've got a crisis here. And in Libya, Max, I mean, consider the gravity of what has taken place there. We're talking a refugee crisis of biblical proportions, the worst refugee crisis since the Second World War. And Boris Johnson recently talked about the need to turn back these ships of desperate refugees as they try to cross the Mediterranean to some semblance of a normal life. And he's talking about implementing a more aggressive policy of withdrawing any safety ships, any life-saving ships to try and save them because they're on these unseaworthy vessels. I mean, as I said, this is a moral sickness. And to think that these are members of the most privileged and rich class in society, what do you think it's going to take before we see a sea change in this fanaticism that drives Western governments and has done for far too many years?
Yeah, I don't know, because they have so many failed models to draw on, and each time they keep pushing for more. I mean, with respect to the refugee crisis, there is simply no analysis or understanding of the refugee crisis. It's a manufactured problem that has been brought on by Western proxy war and direct interventionism, starting with Libya. And if I'm not incorrect, the Cameron government actually supported an EU proposal to militarily target smuggler ships in port in Libya, to actually go back and attack Libya all over again. Gaddafi and his son had warned explicitly that a refugee crisis would result from his removal. But that was worth the price. And just going back to your earlier point, it was worth the price for various elite elements that don't really represent common Europeans or common Libyans. One great point besides the oil company, the oil
Max, just
dimension.
Hold that thought. We're going to stop for a short break. We'll get back to it. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of Max Blumenthal, journalist and author, and we're discussing recent events in Libya and Syria in the context of the regime change fanaticism, for that is the only word to describe it, fanaticism, that has driven Western foreign policy in the region and elsewhere over the past few years. Sorry, Max, you were talking about events in Libya. Please continue. We're discussing the nature of the refugee crisis and the fact that for Western governments, this was seen as a price worth paying, despite the warnings that were given by Muammar Gaddafi and his sons over the consequences of any military intervention in Libya and in the region.
Well, I was going to mention a book called Slouching Towards Sirte, by Maximilian Fort.
Great book.
And it's a very good book on the intervention. And one of his key points is that the U.S., while Gaddafi had given up his nuclear weapons, his chemical weapons stocks, and normalized relations with the West, and pretty much handed the store, given away basically his deterrent capacity. He didn't have nuclear weapons. He had a kind of a nuclear program that was not quite a weapons program yet. But another motivation was AFRICOM. Libya under Gaddafi was leading the counterweight to AFRICOM, the African Union. And AFRICOM is the U.S., really the American anchor in the African continent through
one of six global
military.
Regional military commands that the U.S. operates, AFRICOM.
Right, exactly. And it works with regional partners who are essentially, U.S. stooges like the government of Uganda, and various other kind of right-wing governments that have opened up to the U.S. at the expense of their own development. Now AFRICOM is expanding, and you also saw the destabilization of Libya provide a way back into the continent for the French military and for France through the operation in Timbuktu in Mali, which had been overwhelmed by Boko Haram, whose fighters had taken arms, received arms, sold on the black market that had previously belonged to the Libyan military. Then with the refugee crisis, you're seeing massive contracts to all the different companies that work with Frontex, the group that, the organization that patrols Europe's borders, the borders of Fortress Europe. So this has been good for business in a lot of ways that extend beyond the oil industry. And that should be disturbing to Europeans, to average people in Europe. And the other thing that should be disturbing is that their politicians are not addressing the refugee crisis at its roots. And that even includes people like Nigel Farage of UKIP in the UK, who has been an opponent of military intervention, but he takes the consequences of these interventions, which is helpless people who are fleeing conflict and poverty in sub-Saharan and North Africa, and blames them for the problem and makes them the scapegoat. And it confuses people who are themselves on the economic brink, who are native, native English people. What we need to have is a holistic analysis that addresses the problem at its roots. And the only person I've heard that from is Jeremy Corbyn, who may be the next prime minister, and that, may set a trend. I don't know if that trend will spread across the Atlantic, because in the United States we've accepted something like 50,000 refugees. The problem isn't as extreme here because of geographic reasons. And so Americans are able to kind of make these wars and blithely topple these countries. And Europe has to accept all the refugees that we create.
Yes, we're less cocooned from the consequences of our government's actions. and but they extend huge resources with the aid of their media acolytes in trying to deny that the refugee crisis is actually connected to foreign policy. You mentioned Nigel Farage, and you're absolutely right. He seeks to demonise the victims of Western foreign policy, even while railing against Western foreign policy, which is a prime example of cognitive dissonance. But Max, if we could turn to Syria, I was very struck by the statement of US General Raymond Thomas at the Aspen Security Forum in July, when he was asked by a journalist from the Washington Post if US forces will remain in Syria after Daesh or ISIS or Islamic State, whatever you want to call them, is defeated. And he responded, and I quote, "We are a bad day away from the Russians saying, 'Why are you still in Syria?'" And this, I think, penetrates the fog and the miasma of propaganda, because, as you know, Max, US forces, as we speak, are in Syria in violation of international law. I think we can safely say that the conflict in Syria is approaching its post-Daesh stage, if it hasn't already entered that stage. How do you see this playing out going forward with regard to Syria? And what do you think the US agenda is in Syria going forward?
That's a great question. And I don't think we have an answer, because the United States doesn't have an answer. It's simply the U.S. is currently run, I even mean the Trump administration, by a collection of generals or former generals who believe that the more the U.S. has a presence around the world perpetually, and that the longer it employs counterinsurgency methods, the better off the United States will be. You know, that obviously speaks to a lot of contracts and an increase in the military budget, but it's also a sort of a faith-based understanding of the world by these generals, people like H.R. McMaster, General Jim Mattis. And that's what the U.S. has done in Syria, a place where it previously had no military presence. There was not one military base in Syria, and that was a source of deep frustration. The only country in the Arab League that was aligned with Russia. And so now you have at least 7 de facto U.S. bases on the Syrian-Iraqi border, starting with the one at the Awalid border crossing at Al-Tanf. And there have been several skirmishes in which Iranian or Shia militia members have been killed. Iranian soldiers or Shia militia members have been killed by U.S. forces. And today we saw around Manbij, near the Kurdish areas, the U.S. skirmishing with, this is so ironic, the former U.S. proxy known as the Free Syrian Army, which is now operating under the auspices of the Turkish military. So the U.S. is stirring things up in Syria. It's using ISIS as a pretext to dig its claws into the country. And it's completely unclear what its long-term agenda is, although there is one, at least one short-term goal, and that is disrupting the contiguity of what people in Washington refer to as the Shia Crescent, which is basically, you know, the influence, the Shia influence that extends from Baghdad to Damascus all the way to southern Lebanon through Hezbollah, which is the Iranian and Syrian proxy, but it's also a Lebanese militia and political movement that has a deep sort of well of support in Lebanese society. And the U.S. is extremely worried about that, mainly because Israel's worried about it. It's the first time there's been a contiguous route from Baghdad to, you know, the southern Beirut area.
And this will explain the airstrikes that Israel has been conducting, which I mentioned in my introduction, wouldn't it? This is what the motive here is to try and disrupt this network.
Well, yeah, I mean, Israel was trying to prevent it from taking place. And it would always say, the Israeli military would always say, we are attacking Hezbollah arms depots and Hezbollah positions. But there, it was unclear whether they were also attacking the Syrian government. And then you have the situation in the Golan, where Hezbollah has just run al-Qaeda out of Arsal. That's not in the Golan. It's on the Lebanese border. But the forces in the Golan, which is near Israeli-occupied territory, we are seeing al-Qaeda and ISIS be forced out. And I think it was the Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, he said last week, ISIS is being forced out. Iran is coming in. This is a disaster. Israel preferred ISIS to be there. It preferred the Sunni jihadi forces to be there. And in many cases, when there was a fight between the Syrian army and the rebels who were led by Al-Qaeda and even ISIS in the Golan area, Israel would provide artillery support and sometimes even air support. So now it's faced with the situation where Hezbollah has forward offensive capacity that it's gathered through Syria. It's recovering because it's no longer as deeply invested in the Syrian conflict. And the forces that Israel had depended on through a tactical alliance are gone. So what you could see is actually an intensification of Israeli provocations, although I don't think that the country, for domestic reasons, for military reasons, is prepared to actually fight Hezbollah head-to-head right now.
Hezbollah's role in Syria cannot be overstated, Max. I mean, they have committed upwards of 9,000 to 10,000 soldiers. They have incurred serious losses given the size of this force. And I think it's fair to say that without their participation in the conflict beginning in 2013, or at least that was when it was admitted by Hassan Nasrallah, the organization's titular head, that it could have been a different result. We could have been now talking about Syria as another failed state. Your thoughts on the role of Hezbollah and on Trump's statement with regard to Hezbollah, describing it in the same terms as Daesh and Al-Qaeda?
Well, just briefly, I mean, I agree. If we had seen regime change in Syria, it's fairly obvious, given the composition of the rebels and given the composition of their popular base to the extent that they had one, that we would have seen a kind of Libya situation or something closer to Afghanistan in the early 90s, when you saw the war of the warlords between the former CIA-backed proxies, and 50% of Kabul was destroyed as they vied for power. The U.S. eventually, along with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, supported the Taliban to restore order. And something like that could have taken place in Syria. Either way, it would have been an absolute disaster. Hezbollah participated in the Syrian theater to preserve its own survival, to preserve itself. Syria was the main route which it received its arms shipments and all of its support. Syria was a stalwart supporter of Hezbollah. But Hezbollah also had another motivation that's scarcely ever acknowledged, which was to prevent these Takfiri jihadi forces from actually gaining a toehold inside Lebanese society, which would have been catastrophic for average Lebanese people, and particularly the base that supports Hezbollah, which is not just Shia, but also Christian. And Hezbollah has actually preserved Lebanon's pluralistic character, most recently by defeating Al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, at Arsal on the Lebanese-Syrian border. And what did it do? What did Hezbollah fighters do when they took Al-Qaeda positions? They not only posted Hezbollah flags, but above those flags, they posted Lebanese national flags. Now, for Donald Trump to equate that organization with ISIS is, of course, false and morally disgusting. And it's false also from a national security perspective, because Hezbollah poses no threat to the United States, has no intention to attack the U.S. or its assets. I mean, you know, you have to go back to the 80s to find an example of that. But in Washington, where I live, you hear that rhetoric every day, all the time. Just walk into a think tank like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, whose quote-unquote experts testify before Congress every week on the Middle East, and you'll hear them declare that Hezbollah is a much greater threat, and it's because their target is Iran. They are backed by pro-Israel forces in Washington, and pro-Israel billionaires like Sheldon Adelson are backing Donald Trump, regardless of what Donald Trump does domestically, stirring up the flames of neo-Nazism, because Sheldon Adelson's main goal is war on Iran. That's why he donated $100 million to Mitt Romney in 2012 to prevent the election of Barack Obama, who had every intention of carrying out the Iran deal. And now you see Trump actually violating the Iran deal by sanctioning Iran. The Iran deal explicitly states that the U.S. not only is to not interfere with the business dealings of Iran, it's supposed to encourage foreign investment in Iran. So the U.S. is violating the Iran deal, and it seeks to sabotage it under Donald Trump. And it's for this very reason that I just explained. And I think we're careening towards a possible disaster in the next few years.
You've been listening to Max Blumenthal. If you haven't already, please check out his book, The 51-Day War, Resistance and Ruin in Gaza, and also his other book, Go Live, which is a searing analysis of Israeli politics in recent years. You can also check him out at his podcast, ModerateRebelsRadio.com. You've been listening to Max Blumenthal. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.